Well, welcome everybody to the TQR podcast, along with my co-editors-in-chief, Sally St. George and Dan Wolf. We're joined today by Dr. Jessica Parker and Dr. Veronica Richard. And we're going to talk about artificial intelligence and how it relates to qualitative research. You may not be able to see the screen, but we're also joined by a couple of our AI friends, Veronica's Otter AI and Reed AI. We're on Zoom today, and these are some of the tools that are becoming almost commonplace and part of how we interact with each other and how we can enhance the human interaction with our sort of human friends. And so we're going to talk a little bit more today about that. And so what we wanted to do, kind of break down our conversation maybe into three parts, today or yesterday, today and tomorrow. And so with the yesterday part, I'm going to turn over to Jessica and Veronica to talk about, you've already heard where Sally, Dan, and I were doing yesterday, but we received a paper a few months ago from Veronica and Jessica, along with their colleague, Kimberly Becker, and we were just blown away by it. It's been published in TQR in September, and then we received another paper from them that we're publishing in December of this year. So we're really excited about their work, and so want to have a conversation with them today. So Jessica, Veronica, maybe you could start with tomorrow, and then we'll move into today.
Sure, or yesterday.
And yesterday.
Yeah, so I'll just briefly start, and then I'll just to give the listeners an idea of the sort of the perspectives that we're offering here. So Veronica and I have worked together really closely for the past 5 years, and we work with primarily PhD candidates across all disciplines. Veronica is my in-house qualitative methodologist, and she is heavily involved in supporting them at really all stages of their research, from helping them conceptualize their study all the way to sort of holding their hand through the data analysis process. And so she's definitely very well positioned to talk about sort of how things have been done in qualitative research in the past. And then really where I come in is I'm also a researcher. I'm not a methodologist. And I've had experience developing, you know, interview protocols, but I'm definitely not as an expert as Veronica. So when I started learning about this technology, I immediately started thinking about how it could support us, because we work with many students who are really at all levels of experience. But for
and
most,
that's a dissertation by design. Is that where that happens?
Yeah, that's dissertation by design. And many of our clients come to us and they've never done research before. And even though maybe they've had a couple of classes, maybe that those classes were a few years ago. And so they're really sort of a blank slate. And Veronica, you know, has been doing things the way they're typically done. And so Veronica, do you want to just comment on like what your normal process would be from a qualitative research perspective?
Yeah. First, we go through an alignment process, making sure that their questions and design make sense qualitatively. And I think that's where a lot of things can go wrong, because novice researchers don't have a good grasp of the research designs. So making sure that their research questions alone are aligned with the design is a challenge. Then when we move into developing our tools as researchers, such as the interview protocol, that becomes even more important to have that alignment. And ultimately, helping people look forward. And what I mean by that is understanding that what we do now in our development of our tools, our planning of our research, impacts what we get in our analysis and what we're able to do in the long run. And so I think that's kind of the pieces of it, and helping them make those connections and seeing that what we have now and what we do now impacts what we will be able to do later with the research.
And we see that a lot, unfortunately, with the finished reports of the lack of alignment. I wrote a paper many years ago about keeping things plumb. And we'll see assertions in one part of the paper It's a little bit like the old Monty Python, and now for something completely different. You know, what in the abstract, they use three different terms for their methodology. The methodology does appear in the keywords, which is a key concern on our part. And then when you get into the paper, we talk about that you have the designer studies where they follow the design of a, you know, char mass and step by step. Sometimes it's a bit more generic. And the one we worry about, we call the knockoff, where they say it's Gucci, but it's not Gucci. And I shouldn't use that because I know Gucci made their own knockoffs. That's probably a bad example now. But it's just you know, we're waiting for the grounded theory. Is the grounded theory coming? And it never, like Godot, it never arrives. And so that's where we love that really attracted us to the work you're doing, is that in a very small moment where things can go, it's like when the play goes wrong, where everything can go wrong. And unfortunately, the students don't know, they don't have that guidance, and they don't know they've gotten off the path and away it goes. And then we're faced with getting a report where we go like, oh boy, we try to assume they've done a good study, but I think what you're doing is gives a greater assurance that maybe they are doing a better job of engineering that that methodology.
Yeah, and I think, Adam, that's such a, or I'm sh- sorry, Ron, that's such an important
He's better looking
aspect
than me. That's okay.
Because I'm working with someone right now on their findings, and they didn't ask the strong follow-up questions in their interview. And so it's very literal.
Well, you know, to me, it's also an ethical thing, is that someone has given their time, they're going to share their story.
Yes.
And you didn't, it's almost like a version of social justice. I mean, you know, the whole thing about qualitative is you're giving someone a chance to tell their story, and it's always difficult to tell your story. You know more than what you want to say. And that's how that interviewer should really work with that. And it's almost like you might as well have just done a survey and put a little box up there and said that why to do that like Cavell's book, The Interviews of the two
right.
folks that way. So that's why I really like how your work, that you practice getting that out with the AI process.
Yeah, and then I would just add, like, beyond, you know, right now we've been talking about novice researchers, but even as an experienced researcher, like I teach my doctoral students how to conduct research. And even for me, there's so time consuming when you think about like things that we touched on in the article are, it's not just building the interview protocol, or building whatever tool you're using to collect data, but there's also the idea of you want to pilot it. And then if you have a limited sample, you don't want to like squander that sample by using someone to pilot. And so we have limited resources oftentimes, or maybe we're not always in the position to do a pilot. And so there's these common problems that come up regardless of whether you're novice or experienced researcher. And that's, you know, there's so many like valuable takeaways from this technology. And I think that's a big one when you come from the perspective of, okay, how can I leverage this tech in order to like give me feedback and even pilot the protocol? Even as an instructor, like using GPT-4 or ChatGPT to generate interview transcripts so that my students can practice just coding without having to go off and do a pilot. The fact that you can generate, you know, a transcript in an instant from, you know, you can give it the perspective of, okay, pretend you're in this cultural context, or this has been your lived experience, and ChatGPT or any of these large language models can do that. And that really presents an opportunity in a classroom to do things that we've just never been able to do before.
I really like the Sally and Dan have talked about research as daily practice. And so what I like about it is that you're reflective practitioners. You are helping people to improve their research, but at the same time, you are reflecting upon and collecting data based upon, you know, it's like we're getting a lot of complaints. Let's just add more people to the helplines. No, let's try to fix the solution going forward. And I think that's a really good move on your part. What I just suggest maybe is, I'm not sure our audience, how many folks are familiar with generative AI and those things. If you could kind of give us maybe a minute or two, a primer on that, and then we can start talking about how Academic Insights Labs emerged, and we mm-hmm. can start moving into today and tomorrow.
Sure. Yeah. So I will just start by saying a disclaimer. I am not a computer scientist. I'm an AI enthusiast, and I've really dedicated the better part of this year to learning as much as I can about this technology, since I really became infatuated with it earlier in the year. And so Kimberly has a really good sort of story that she tells to help people understand the differences between like what a typical computer software does and then transitioning to what machine learning, deep learning, and then generative AI is. And so I'll just tell a very short part of that story. So generative AI, which is where we have these large language models such as ChatGPT, Bard, Bing, these are forms of generative AI, which we found through deep learning. Deep learning is a subset of machine learning. And how this differs from like a typical computer software is when you program a computer software, you basically tell it all of the rules, you tell it what to do, so you get this very predictable, prescriptive output. Well, with machine learning and deep learning, you're basically feeding it lots of examples of what's good and what's bad, and then it creates the rules. And so it's a lot faster than programming. And so these large language models have been trained on billions of parameters of data. There's people all over the world. There's a lot of sort of ethics and debates about this right now. There's people actually sitting at computers training these models about, yes, this is a stoplight. That's not a stoplight. That's a car. That's a banana. That's not a banana. Like training it on what's right and what's wrong. And then it creates the rules. And so, but as the output goes, it's not a software. I could prompt it and Veronica could input the exact same prompt right beside of me and we would get slightly different output. And so you're not going to be able to control the output like you would with a computer software. But where these generative AI models really shine, or these large language models, is the ability to generate content. It's original content. It's not being plagiarized. It's not being picked up from a specific source and output. And so you can run them through plagiarism detectors and they don't pick it up as plagiarism because that's not how they work. They're producing truly original content in seconds. You can produce text now with DALL-E. Lots of AI image creators. We can create images, videos, voice synthesis. Like it's pretty wild what it can do. And so there's lots of applications of this technology in research and outside of research. And so I began really just kind of experimenting with ChatGPT-3 when it was first released. And, you know, I think like many users, I was at first just playing around with it, getting it to write silly poems or helping it improve my emails or just like brainstorming different ideas. And then I quickly started to see the applications and how we could use it to improve like our work with our clients. And also I used it to start revamping my course materials to improve my course materials, create like individualized learning plans. And then I started experimenting with research. And so back in, this was happening around February, and then I was working closely with Dr. Kimberly Becker. She's my co-founder at Academic Insight Lab. She's an applied linguist and she's a corpus linguist. And so she's like perfectly positioned to understand this technology and she's taught me quite a bit. And that's when we formed Academic Insight Lab. We started creating some really custom tools for very specific applications. So essentially what we have learned is you can go into ChatGPT and everyone's talking about prompt engineering. So technically you could have like a library of prompts that you keep and then you input it just into ChatGPT whenever you want to use a prompt for a specific purpose.
Yeah, a little routine, like writing a program, yeah.
Yeah, and it's time consuming. I mean, when you're using these programs for academic purposes, I mean, you just think about what goes into creating, I don't know, a grading rubric. You have these specific criteria. And so it's not as simple as just throwing that rubric into ChatGPT and saying, create this paper. You want to give it some role and context. You want to do few shot prompting, give it examples of an A grade paper, of an F grade paper. Like, there's all these little things you can do. And so as you can imagine, that can be quite time consuming. And so we started creating custom tools for very specific applications so that we've done all the prompt engineering on the back end and we've done the few shot prompting, we've fed it examples, and we've created data sources to in order to better train the model on what we want the output to be. And so that's sort of what I've been working on the past several months. And then Veronica and I have been working together from a research on the qualitative research end for creating tools for qualitative researchers to accompany some of our research. And so the article we wrote on using large language models for developing and refining interview protocols, we created a tool to accompany that so that, yes, like a savvy user could take our article and they could take all the prompts that we published and they could use that and they could certainly go into ChatGPT and replicate what we've done. But, you know, I think most people are inherently not interested in keeping track of all of those prompts. And so for those people who want to sort of move through that a bit faster with a bit more ease, you know, they can use custom tools. And we're not the only ones developing these custom tools. There's quite a few companies coming out right now who are doing the same.
You know, the way you talk about it, Sally and Dan and I were family therapists. One of the people that we read is Gregory Bateson. And Bateson talked about all messages have, there's three aspects to it. There's the report, the command, and the relationship. So for example, you know, you walk by your kid's room and you're saying that the your room is dirty. Yeah, that's what you're saying, right? The report, you know, it's dirty. You think you're saying clean your room. Now, whether or not the kid will clean the room based upon that prompt has a lot to do with your relationship that you have with that person. And I kind of get that feeling that there is this relationship that's being created. You have certain content that you're sharing, but then that report in term, you know, command message, what do you want based upon that? That's where you get into the linguistics and speech acts and things like that. So it's a challenge with human beings and now doing it with this artificial intelligence, but because it is based upon the human way we interact, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, there's a lot of those similarities and some of the same joys and frustrations can be when you're trying to communicate with someone or something else.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, language is a tool. And these are large language models. And so we can use them as tools, but you still have to learn how to communicate with them. I mentioned this in, I think, the second article we wrote, the garbage in, garbage out principle. You know, if you're not communicating well, you're not likely going to get the output you're looking for.
So yeah, in the future, for family therapists, we'll be working on relationship problems between people and their artificial intelligence programs to make sure that they can work through those issues, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I am really jazzed about as far as these tools are concerned, because they force me to be critical and to really try to recognize what I have assumed when I've gone into my prompt, or what I have assumed in thinking about what is a good interview question. And that to me is something that when I teach the qualitative courses and things like that, it takes weeks to get them to be thinking in ways that that I think they're now engaging in being critical. Oftentimes I see students and sometimes even early scholars in I just have to get it done. And this rush of getting it done, we lose that critical nature. And by using these tools, I see it as a huge benefit of forcing us to really think about what it is that we want and how we're saying these things and how we're prompting. And then what's the output? Are we getting what we need?
Yeah, so we were talking earlier before we got on the podcast about debugging and things like that. And so in a way, and this is, I think, a really great feature of the article that came out in September, is that there's a recursiveness, there's a circularity where I think the young researcher, the novice, keeps going forward. Well, I have my research questions, now my interview questions, and there's no circular going back to see it. And this program helps you to kind of debug, which are really some conceptual, you know, if I was more fatal flaws to their design, they don't even know that they're fatal, but that kind of iterative process, which is a hallmark of qualitative research. You know, if you're doing an experimental model, you stop and they go, wow, this isn't going well, but I've got to keep collecting data because that's part of my protocol. I think that's the strength of this type of learning and the qualitative model, the iterative model is a natural fit for this type of process that you're doing.
Yeah, and I think that's why we chose to use Castillo Montoya's framework, is because that was a way for us to automatically build in this iterative process. So using that framework, and you know, I know we're going to be talking about the future in a little bit, but I think that frameworks are a good way to help us to build in that iterative nature to where that we are thinking through the process rather than just doing.
Could you talk a little bit about Montoya's approach and how the nice symmetry, the connection between what you're doing, why they just really, I think, was really a built-in advantage?
Jessica, you want to go with that? Or?
Sure, yeah. So that framework emphasizes starting out with aligning your interview questions and your research questions. And it's all about creating a matrix so that you can visually easily see, make sure that each interview question is logically connected to a research question, that you don't have interview questions that are unnecessary or not connected.
We have some people that don't know that there is supposed to be a difference.
Right. Yes, we see that too, where the research questions are the interview questions.
Yeah.
And so just that step alone is time consuming. I mean, I know that there's a lot of talk right now about generative AI just with productivity and efficiency, but it's so much more than that. But for this specific step, you think of what I would have normally done, what Veronica would normally have done, is we'd sit down and create a table and we'd manually, you know, try to align each question. Well, now if you're starting with your interview questions, which is how we start out with this, is you come with your interview questions, but you could obviously use these tools to help you develop your initial draft and then you would refine it. But in an instant, you can get a matrix. So that's time saving. It doesn't mean it's perfect. That's something we talk about in the next article, is these generative AI large language models. They're just predictive models. They're not humans critically thinking about how these concepts are connected. They're just predicting the next word based off of the previous word. And so they're not perfect. They're not 100% accurate. And so with Castillo Montoya's framework, you're creating that matrix. And so when you're adding in a language model to that step, you could ask it to create the matrix, and then you simply need to review it, and you'll probably need to modify it. It's not going to be perfect. You might need to move it around, and then, or you could give it instructions like move to question 3 under research question 1, and it'll adjust the matrix for you. So then you have your matrix, and once you've determined that there is alignment between your research questions and your interview questions, then you move on to the next stage. And the next stage is creating an inquiry-based conversation, which is supposed to follow sort of the rules of a normal social conversation. And Castillo Montoya has like really wonderful guidance built into that initial article about the IPR framework, about how you would go about creating an inquiry-based conversation. And so we use that guidance to create a prompt in order to get ChatGPT to help us sort of take those interview questions and actually creating a full protocol with follow-up prompts, assessing the language, making sure that there's, you know, introductory, key, transition, closing questions. And so before using these large language models, that is a very time-consuming process, like really thinking through what would this now list of interview questions and a matrix look like if I was now having a conversation with a person. And so that
I would be texting while you were having the conversation with
me. Probably multitasking for sure.
Right.
Yeah. And again, these are large language models. Language is a tool. And so these models work really well for thinking through aspects of language and creating an inquiry-based conversation. And so that's that second stage. And then the third stage of the IPR framework is conducting a close read, getting some feedback from a peer, or in this case, a chatbot, to conduct a close read and give you feedback on the tool, on the interview protocol. And then the final stage of Castillo Montoya's framework is piloting the interview protocol. And obviously all of that's a linear, is put forth as a four-stage process, but it's very iterative. Like us, we know as researchers that you're constantly revisiting a previous stage based on what you're learning.
That's the purest sense of context. It's not a hierarchical, it's text with text. And it's that weave that's created. And I think when beginning researchers, they have a hard time with the complexity of it. And in this way, there's a bit of simplicity to it, because you're looking a relationship to relationship, but it kind of helps you take a step back because there's an overall process, there's an overall structure that you're trying to create. And I think that that kind of scaffolding or that kind of structuring really helps the students. But one, they just don't realize the huge gaps. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you see it in writing too. You know, the sentence looks like it came right after the last sentence, but you could drive a truck through between the what's logic. Missing, the tacit knowledge that what they know that they're just not saying. We always say, you know, when I said, you know, your writing's okay, but you're going to have to be on call whenever somebody downloads your dissertation, because you're going to have to explain to them what you really meant to say here. So let's kind of work it out now. I said, the problem is that you're writing this text with all these ideas in mind. They're just not in the text. And I think when you start debugging it, I'll use that term, you can kind of see where there are these gaps. And that's maybe what you were thinking. But at least for now, the AI can't read your mind, I think. So at least they can kind of help to bring those ideas out. And that's a tough thing to do when it's just you. And you'll have someone to knock those ideas off.
And I think, Ron, that's, I don't think that we included this in the article, but I think that using these large language models such as ChatGPT, it's also a safe space to give it a go, right? It's a safe space to say, here are my ideas. Here's the questions I'm thinking about. How will I do with this, right? I think that is because so many, especially doctoral students, it's personal. It becomes this very personal aspect. And when they get feedback from their committee or their supervisors, they take it personal. And they're like, well, they just keep, you know, I can't do anything right.
Probably the same with journal editors, right? We're so cruel. We're so cruel.
Reviewer too.
Exactly. But so this way, it's, I think being that it is maybe a distant other, if you will, it gives them the space to get their ideas out there and think about, hopefully really think about and be critical of their ideas and what they're thinking.
Well, I agree. And I want one last thing about your the article that's coming out in December is you get more into the ethics of these things and that kind of the process. And so kind of the transition to tomorrow, the big $10 trillion question is, can these programs assist with the qualitative data analysis? Hmm. And we have all these programs that are currently existing that call themselves qualitative data analysis programs. I think if you look closely, they're all in quotation marks or in italics in terms of that. And we get this all the time with the TQR articles. And I use fill in the blank to conduct by analysis. And then we know warning signs start going off. And I think this is one of Sally's favorite ones when she sees this and she goes, what do you mean by that? And we kind of get into, of course, we're always trying to say, I know you're using Braun and Clark. How did you use Braun and Clark? At least walk us through the steps. But then that's the big thing. And I think that's what's the exciting part of where y'all are going now in terms of where is qualitative data analysis and how, what are you doing in this venue? You've kind of got them, their questions are good and now they're generating stuff. Now, what about the analysis part?
How we're doing.
Yeah, I guess I would say that we can't take away the researcher. Whether we're using a qualitative data analysis software program, or whether we're using large language models, we still need the researcher to do some checking. I was just using ChatGPT-4 with some data, and it when I said, you know, organize it into these areas, which it'll do very well, it put new information in. Just, I was like, wait a minute, I didn't see that quote before. Where is that quote? I went through all of my transcripts. I'm like, it's not here. And then Jessica, maybe you can speak to this a little bit as far as these hallucinations go, but I was like, oh my goodness, where else has it been doing this? And so I had to go back and check, but the caveat here is that I would not have caught it if I didn't know my data well. I would have let it go because
it was just testing you, Ron. It was just testing.
making sure you're paying attention.
Right.
I think that's a great example. I mean, we're definitely singing the praises of this technology right now, but it's not perfect. It hallucinates. I mean, if you talk to any AI developer, I've been listening to so many podcasts, you know, they'll all say this is a black box. You can ask it to show its work. It'll try to show its work. Sometimes it does a great job of showing its work. But at the end of the day, this AI is not perfect. And GPT-4 is more accurate than GPT-3.5, but it still hallucinates. There's buzz going on right now about GPT-5, what that's going to be like. But yes, they hallucinate. They're not accurate. I think what's even more concerning, especially when you think about novice researchers using them, is it's very confident. It's very confident when it tells you something that is totally untrue or doesn't exist and or not in the data. And for novice researchers, it can be really hard to pick up on that because they're often not nearly as critical as they need to be. And so, yeah, you should 100%. We talk about that so much in the second article with our guidelines is really closely reviewing the output and being very critical of it. Because it's not perfect and it does hallucinate. And Veronica's right. If you're not familiar with your data, you're not going to pick up on that. And that might get you in a world of trouble.
Yeah.
That process should be part of the quality control anyway. And if it's just you doing it, and again, it's having that partner that can kind of help you with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say that there's some definite, I see that ChatGPT in particular, and 4 I'm referring to, is we could put some data in to give us a start of, you know, what are the patterns that are coming up here in regards to this research question or this research question. We can certainly do that. And then that could be a springboard, if you will, to our own analyses. Now, I haven't... Well, let me continue this thought, and then I'll get back to Brown and Clark and some other frameworks as far as analyses goes. But the other way we can do it is I already have my themes. Can I go back and put the data into ChatGPT and see how closely it is to the themes that I've come up with? And so I see it, the potential is working both ways, back and forth. And Ron, something what you said before is kind of starts this iterative process, which all of us know is critical for qualitative data analysis, is we have to go into this checking mode. And you know, I'm thinking that this is coming out. Is this right? Am I really seeing this right? And then the other thing to all of this is that we keep an audit trail. And that we make sure that we're logging in what we're doing when, not only for whoever my reader is, but so that I can help someone else down the line. And then they can maybe take it further.
Yeah, I think that's a big future. This is the moving into the trustworthiness part and being able to kind of see. And even there, what questions did you ask? What questions did you not ask? You know, was it a reliability thing, an accuracy thing, validity thing? It can go all the way up and down with that. And I know, as you're saying, you know, when you have a design where, you know, someone, there's just one treatment and then there's a control group, right? And then you find effectiveness. Well, my intervention was better than nothing, right? And so when you do your analysis now, well, it's better than nothing because there was nothing else being done. You could kind of have a test, like, are there other themes? Now, again, within the research questions, because obviously you can take different ways, but it'll be really kind of cool saying, okay, how would you read this if this were your research questions and these were your interview questions? I don't know if it's to that point, but it does have, kind of have that potential where you test other hypotheses in there and see what comes up. So I mean, it's just kind of when you start thinking more and more how this can really ultimately produce the quality, and but you still the human factor in there, because of that sense-making, I guess, with all of those different pieces.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I'm thinking of Johnny Saldana here, where he talks about this idea of coding and the different aspects of coding, right? And I see a lot of young scholars really be at the literal level of coding. Everything's very much meaning-based, if you will. Like,
what's the family feud? You know, you ask the question, the survey says, there's just a topical survey going on. Yeah.
Well, I kind of was thinking about this the other day, so I put a few quotes that I knew were, I believed were related. And I put it into ChatGPT-4 and I said, what's the overall idea? Because I was struggling to come up with a phrase, right? Like, what's going on here? And when it came up, it wasn't exactly right, but it gave me an idea for what my sub theme would have been. And yeah, so I think that has a lot of potential as well.
I call that applied Sesame Street. You know, three of these things are just like each other. You know, Kermit the Frog would have been very proud.
Well, I must be good at that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone thinks, you know, Sesame Street's all about the count, but that's where kids first learn qualitative data analysis. It's right. in that game right there, how to do those kind of things. And
I love that.
So you mentioned Johnny Saldana, and Adam, are you still with us?
I'm here.
So we actually have you all will be presenting at a pre-conference for the, what day is that, Adam? Put him on the spot.
That'll be February 28th, 2024.
And at the same time, unfortunately, who else is presenting that day?
Johnny Saldana.
Ah, the world is coming together. So hopefully you'll all be able to chat with Johnny about that. He's just wrapping up a workshop today with us on one of our other channels and on the data analysis.
I've attended many.
Yes. So that would be really kind of fun to do that, because it really, I think, is coming together. And I've been so excited about this. I've been kind of dominating the questions and that. And Dan and Sally, would you have some stuff that, I don't get to meet a lot of people anymore. I just sit in my office all day writing memos and doing emails. So the chance to talk to real people is a lot of fun. So what sort of thoughts, because you read the papers too, and you've all worked some other AI papers that we've had published mm-hmm. recently as well.
Well, one of the things I'd like to say is the biggest relief for me, and I think value, is the researcher's important, can't take all of this for granted, needs to check, double check, and go back and forth. But one of the questions I had was, how important is it for us to kind of know the background of what's taking place? Because you said one of the big changes from, I never have the lingo quite right, but the software that's used for, people use for analysis and the language models, is that one, the rules were set, but you said that then the rules get set by the language model. And so is it important that we know that, understand that? And I have no idea what you mean about the rules.
Yeah. So this idea of transparency is very important. I just read an article that was released by, I think it was Bain Consulting Group, where they were looking at the transparency of all these different large language models. And they said they're all being about as transparent as they were about their social media algorithms. And we know what trouble that got us in.
Yeah.
So it showed, like, I'm not going to get this right, but I want to say Facebook's large language model, like Llama, was at the far end. It was like 47% transparent. And then ChatGPT was somewhere in the middle. I want to say it was like, don't quote me on this, around 30 something percent transparent. And so this is inherently problematic. This goes along with part of this black box issue. You can ask the model to like show its work and it'll give you some very confident answers. And maybe that is right. And maybe it's not. Like, we don't, even the AI developers don't actually know. I remember hearing this story early on that, you know, maybe it was ChatGPT, maybe it was one of the others like Claude, but one of these large language models was definitely trained on like English text. All the parameters were in English. And then one day they got up and it was speaking like Portuguese, and they had no idea how that happened, when that happened. And so yes, it's concerning. I think from like a research perspective for transparency, so what I'm having my doc students do in ChatGPT, you can export your chat history. And so I allow them to use ChatGPT. I give them specific instructions for how I would like for them to use it, but I also give them some leeway. But they have to send me their chat history. And so I'm imagining that that maybe is a direction that we go in, where when someone submits an article and they're acknowledging the role of the AI, then maybe you're asking for a link to their chat history. So you can actually see all of those conversations. Obviously, if someone's reviewing that, that seems quite cumbersome. I don't know if I would want that job, scrolling through all that chat history.
Well, but just the fact we might ask for it, though.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's probably a good practice. And that's a relatively newish feature in ChatGPT. I don't use the other models enough to know what those options are there. But like, I think that that will be important for transparency in research.
Yeah, and I think that also has the potential to show the critical nature of the researcher or the user. And did they make any changes based on the outcome? And why did they make those changes? And I think that is the key. If I'm making a change, but I'm not logging it for myself of why I've made this change, I'm missing out on an opportunity for growth and reflexivity, quite frankly, because I want to gain awareness of why I think it needed to be altered to begin with. And then how am I going to make that change? What am I going to do with my language? I think that right there is a potential and a potential loss if we're not doing that.
Yeah, it's like there's so many people, I mentioned this earlier, where there seems to be all this hype about automation and productivity and efficiency. But I think from specifically when we're talking about research, it's like the time that maybe you're saving building that matrix, you're spending in more reflection and critical thinking. And so what I talk about augmentation, and I think that where these tools can save us time, we can then invest that time in other ways to improve the quality of our work. And so just like a simple example, when we were working on that guidelines article, you know, maybe my typical process is I like to write in the morning, I get up, I sometimes have writer's block. Sometimes I'm just like agonizing over every word. I want to wordsmith. Well, now I'll use like ChatGPT to get me going, so I don't have writer's block anymore. And that gives me more time to explore counter arguments, which maybe I didn't have time to do that before. Now I can ask it, help me see my assumptions, help me anticipate potential criticisms of this argument, help me explore, you know, 10 different rebuttals. And that is strengthening the quality of my work. Whereas before, I maybe would have been wordsmithing or just agonizing over a phrase or can't, you know, get the writing started. And so I think that's like the message I'm giving my doc students is, I don't want you to use these tools so that now it takes you 3 hours instead of 8. I want you to then take that time you would have normally spent, you know, building a table or a matrix and really critically thinking about its output, your input, what you would do differently. And then how are you going to improve? What are you going to do based on what you've noticed and learned?
Hey, Jessica, I want to go back to Sally's question for just a moment on the transparency. And I know that you and Kimberly have been developing these tools, and that kind of takes the prompting aspect away from the user. Is that right? Like, you've developed it so that when they put stuff in, you've done the prompting for them. So I'm just wondering if you could maybe talk about that and how your tools might be an avenue of transparency.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll use this, the tool that we created to accompany the article that was published in September. So in the article, we clearly talk about how we use Castillo Montoy's framework, which you can go pull up that article and look at the framework. And then we publish our prompts. And so in that tool, we have a link to Castillo Montoya's article, we have a link to our article, and we make it clear that we use the prompts in our article to build the tool on the back end. And so the client or whoever's using it knows, they can go look up our article and see that these are the prompts that are going to be on the back end. Obviously, we haven't done research on all of our tools. We have like 70 of them, but that's like what we're focusing on moving forward is either we're doing research and so that someone can look up our prompting or the criteria, or we're using a published article that already has a framework and criteria so they can go and look up that article or just a resource to see what is the criteria for. Like, we just created one for Likert scales that generates Likert scales. And we used a well-known framework for building Likert scales in the social sciences. And so the user could go to that article and see this is the criteria that goes into the Likert scale questionnaire generator. And so that's the transparency that we're providing for like our criteria and our prompting. But our tools are built on GPT-4. And so they're inherently limited by any transparency issues with GPT-4. That's just the reality of it. So we can only be as transparent as the model architects are transparent with us in terms of what's happening like within the architecture of the model. But yeah, I think that that's important for researchers to do. Anytime we're using these models, we need to be really clear on exactly what our prompts are. We need to be publishing our prompts, not keeping them secret. There needs to be full transparency in our prompting and our criteria for how we're evaluating the quality of the output. And so we tried to give researchers that in the December article. But the truth is that this is so new, you know, a year from now, 6 months from now, that guidelines article, how we're defining that criteria might be quite different just based on the transparency of what we're getting from these large language models, the developers themselves.
Well, thank you. I appreciate hearing how being explicit is really, really important. Thanks.
And we kind of do what we call like a living document. You certainly are welcome to come back and to edit and so forth. But speaking of prompts, Adam just sent me a prompt and said that we're about at the end of our time. And I just thank you all this went very fast for me in terms of the conversation. I think we're just kind of getting started with this. And so I want to thank Jessica and Veronica for joining us today. And say we have the one article that they published that was in September of 2023. And another one will be coming out in December of this year. And if you have time, maybe you can join us next year for the conference and catch them. And you do a podcast as well. Is that correct?
We've had a few episodes. I'm having a hard time keeping up with it because we're...
I've had a few episodes too, but it has nothing to do with podcasting.
So. Yeah, so on Academic Insight Lab, if you go to our YouTube channel... So we have a YouTube channel for Dissertation by Design. And on Academic Insight Lab, we have two podcast episodes. We're a very small team. It's me and Kim at Academic Insight Lab, and we wear about 25 different hats. So we put out podcast episodes when we can.
You wear the hats very well. We thank you so much today. I think we'll be doing this a little bit more in the future. So thanks, everybody. Adam, this is where you then play the outgoing music, right? Thank you.